The hosts of Family Anatomy are psychologists, but they're not your psychologists. So if you want to talk to someone about family or mental health issues, you can get a referral from your family doctor. This show is for information only.
Welcome to Family Anatomy, your source for parenting and relationship information, with your hosts, Dr. Giuseppe Spazzano
and Dr. Brian McDonald. We are once again, well, we're in the studio together once again.
Yeah.
That's kind of a big deal. I was talking with rock stars last time around.
You were.
And now I've got you.
Yeah, you were on tour with rock stars for a couple of episodes.
It seemed like that. It felt like I was on tour with Courage My Love a little while back, but now we're back in the studio with real recording equipment.
So what you're saying is you missed me.
Of course I did.
Right.
I miss my fancy microphone. Maybe that's it. Maybe that's what I missed. But we're back with an anatomy of three things, three research stories that we found that we thought were pretty cool.
That's right. And do you want to, I think we should talk about them a little bit, give people a sense of what we're going to be.
We'll tease them with a few details before we get into the real meat of these stories. So the first one that I brought to the table was all about how having dads in the home and a little bit about what dads do when they're in the home has an impact on kids' IQ and their emotional functioning later on in life.
And the second research story we're going to talk about is how we know that conflict is related to marital difficulties, but also how does love interactions affect marital outcomes and difficulties?
You're all about the research on marriage. That's right. And here's another, this is one that I found, and you would think right away, as soon as you hear about it, you'd think this was a story that Dr. Spazzano wanted to talk about. And that's, in a way, that's why I picked it. And it's about how studies about medication, drug studies, are often misleading.
See, that's positive influence from me towards you.
Do you think that's what it is?
That's exactly what it is.
Yeah, you think that's it?
You're learning a few things.
Oh, boy. Is that what happens to me?
Yes.
I don't know if I want you to rub off on me.
Don't be sad.
If only I had some medication, I would probably feel happier.
All right.
So let's talk about the first one. Let's talk about dads, right?
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that we already know from previous research is that it's good to have your dad around.
Makes sense.
In a nutshell, right?
Sure. But I mean, they're looking more specific. This is a really recent piece of research too, 2011.
Yeah, it's in the brand new issue, I think, of a Canadian journal, the Canadian Journal of Behavioral Science. And it's some researchers, I believe, out of Montreal who went and looked at previous research that found even after you control for the amount of money that's coming into the house, having dads around has a positive impact on kids.
And this, they're sort of following up on a lot of research that's been done before. Like you said, we know that having fathers in the home is associated with better cognitive outcomes, and it's related to better behaviors. I guess one of the things they wanted to do was follow it up in a more longitudinal way.
That's right. One of the things that, well, you know what? The jury's a little bit out on whether or not after you control for the income, whether or not there's a real impact on intellectual functioning and emotional functioning, having the dad around or not. Because in a lot of the research, what they find out is that if there's not a father in the house, there's a difference in income that's coming in, right? So not every single study has consistently found that once you control for the income thing, that there's still a unique effect of having the dad around. So they wanted to clarify that. And also a lot of the previous research was done with 2 and 5-year-olds. So it's real little kids.
Right.
So the new study was looking at kids between the age of 6 and 10, and then it followed them up around 3 years later when they were somewhere between 9 and 13 years old.
That's right. And so they followed about 138 kids and their families. And they looked at a lot of different things, the father's presence in the home, their socioeconomic status, the type of parenting that was being used by the parents in the house. And this is something we've talked about before, whether it was more authoritarian parenting or whether it was more democratically oriented parenting.
Whether they were more concerned about being the boss or more concerned about their kids' understanding of what the limits are and include some warmth and some consultation, you might even say, with the kids about the rules.
Yeah, and then they also looked at the conflict within the home and the home environment and the behavior problems.
And they did observations. It wasn't just an interview or a questionnaire or a form or a survey that some people filled out. They did some observations as well, and they did IQ tests with the kids, and they really wanted to see, okay, well, once we control for all of these other factors, is there a real impact of having dad around versus not having dad around on things like IQ? And on internalizing problems, they call them, right? Like depression or anxiety, things like that.
So, yeah. So what did they find? They found that fathers who were, the more present they were and the more democratic their parenting style.
Right.
The higher, now this is going to be something we should explain to the higher their, what we talk about as performance IQ. Explain that a little bit.
Okay, well, performance IQ, really, whenever I was working with it, I always called it nonverbal IQ. And it refers to visual, spatial kinds of reasoning, things like being able to figure out patterns and put puzzles together and put things in order, being able to work quickly, that is a big factor in performance IQ as well. So it's nonverbal things, because one of the things they found was that having dads around versus not around didn't have any impact on verbal performance on the IQ test. It was only on the nonverbal measures.
Right. So, and one of the things they hypothesized is the reason that there's, it's not a large increase, but it's a significant increase in their visual spatial ability.
That's right. Now, we talked before. Remember when we were talking about junk food and IQ, and that was a very different study from this one, because the junk food study used half of an IQ test, and I don't really even know how. Then they multiplied everything by two, and then they found there was a 1 or a 2 point difference. And this difference is bigger, and they used an actual IQ test in order to find the information and follow people over years. So it's certainly, I would say, a more well-designed study than the one about the junk food and IQ. But like I said, they didn't find a huge impact on the verbal side, but on the nonverbal side, the visual spatial reasoning, it was a fairly large, a significant change.
Right. And one of the things they hypothesized, like, why would that make a difference?
Can I take a guess? Around?
Well, they have a guess in the article.
Let me give you my psychic impression of what they
Let's
probably
see if it
said.
Matches what they think. What was not necessarily the truth. It's just the hypothesis that they have. Go ahead.
My guess is going to be that dads tend to be the ones who are more involved in hands-on kind of play and roughhousing kind of play, and are more involved in problem-solving kinds of things, active kinds of things, than the moms are, and the moms are more involved maybe on the verbal side.
I'm going to assume that you read that in the article and then you're not brilliant, or that your crystal ball is not what actually brought you to that conclusion.
I purposely did not read the conclusions of the study before I was sitting down here today. That's just my brilliant intuition.
Why would you? You know that I was going to cover for you. That's probably why.
Why do I need
anyway,
to read?
So yeah, through play activities is what they're hypothesizing, that the dads are more involved with this.
I mean, that makes, as a dad, okay, that makes sense to me anyway.
Yeah,
the kinds of things dads are interested in doing with kids tends to be the physical rough and tumble, or the dads do tend to be, they call it instrumental, right? Guys tend to be more instrumental. The problem, we need to solve these problems. And that's the kinds of tests that we're talking about when we're looking at that nonverbal IQ. So they're getting more practice maybe on that side if their dad's around than if he's not.
That's right. It's a more physically oriented kind of a measure too. You know, your engagement with the physical world around you.
Right? Yeah, there's fine motor stuff and things like that, of course. But what about the mood part? What about those internalizing problems? What did they find there? My guess, are you ready? Having dads around without... I honestly, did I read this study? Having dads around probably was related to fewer problems with depression and worry. Am I right?
You're so close to being right. So close to being right. You are right, except that they found it only for the girls. But you know, the thing is, when you read further into the discussion,
which
you know,
did.
They're not 100% confident of that particular result, because the typical thing that you, because there's been a lot of research in the area prior to this, and you typically see that it affects both boys and girls,
right?
When fathers are involved for the younger kids.
Mm.
So that's something they said would require further investigation to see how robust that finding is. But yeah, it's for this particular study, it was girls, when fathers were around more,
right?
Girls were more likely to not have these kind of difficulties with anxiety and depression and that kind of thing.
Well, interesting, but they're not sure what the reason is because it doesn't fit with the previous research.
That's right.
Well, let's talk about the next one, because probably listening to our description of what dads do versus what moms do might cause conflict among couples who are listening to the show.
It might. And so, yeah, this one, what happened for this particular research, Conflict in Love, it's called the Predicting Newlywed Marital Outcomes from Two Interaction Contexts. You know, that title is almost decipherable.
Nearly so. You sent this one to me and I was like, oh boy, this is going to be a tough one to wade through. It's another brand new August 2011 in the issue of Journal of Family Psychology, a brand new study hot off the presses. It was still warm when I got it in my email.
Yes.
It was nice.
I had to bite right in there while it was warm. I like the way they make this this electronic information still kind of real, by making it warm or cold.
And hot off the presses.
Yeah.
You know, here's the thing about marital conflict. When I looked at the beginning of this study, when they're talking about past research on marital conflict, who are they talking about? None other than John Gottman, who was the guy that, I mean, when I was learning how to do family therapy, he was the one who did the research on marital conflict when I was doing my training.
Right.
And so he talked a lot about the kinds of things you're not supposed to do when you're getting into a conflict with your spouse.
Right.
Right. Do you remember the Four Horsemen?
I do not.
He talked about the Four Horsemen of the apocalypse, the marital apocalypse, I guess. And these are four behaviors that happen when you're in a battle with your spouse that are highly predictive of divorce later on. You want to know what they are?
Let's hear them.
Are you ready for this? One of them is criticism. And the way they talk about criticism is things like, rather than commenting on your partner's behavior, you're commenting on their personality. Rather than saying, hey, you know, you didn't take the garbage out today, they're saying, you are so lazy. You didn't take the garbage out today.
Right.
I can imagine that would make you feel pretty rotten in a relationship, right?
Well, you're affecting that person's self-esteem at that point. Eh?
That's right. Now, number two is contempt. Not contempt of court, but showing contempt for your spouse through put downs and insults and eye rolling.
Yeah.
You rolled your eyes when I said that.
Is contempt a fancy word for hatred?
Contempt. Maybe. I don't know about hatred, but you're showing disdain. I'd say disdain.
There's another fancy word for,
like disdain.
For
okay.
Hatred. Yeah.
Number three would be defensiveness. If you get really defensive and what you're doing is making excuses when you're having a conflict, right? That's not going to solve the problem. Or one of the things they talked about in related to defensiveness, or that Gottman used to talk about related to defensiveness, was bringing up a complaint about your partner rather than dealing with whatever the original conflict is. So you try to turn it around on them instead. It's not always a conscious thing, but it's part of being defensive. And then the fourth one is stonewalling, where you just stop talking to each other. And obviously that's something that's an indicator that there's a big problem.
That makes a lot of sense.
That's right.
The thing that these researchers wanted to do, because, you know, it's pretty clear in the research that, you know, expression of negative emotion, like contempt or hatred or disdain or whatever you want to call it.
Right, right.
And also these really difficult behavioral sequences, you know, withdrawing and attacking and that kind of thing that we've talked about before.
Yeah, when we talked to Sue Johnson, right? She talks about that dance that couples get into, the patterns that they get into. And some of that was probably influenced by Gottman, right?
Right. And so they know from research that these negative patterns and these negative emotions predict marital distress. They know that.
Of course they do.
And, you know, the interesting thing is when you're seeing couples in your office, of course, when they come into your office, they're coming because there's a lot of distress. There's a lot of negative emotion. There's a lot of negative behavioral sequences or you know, that withdrawing and attacking, which is the most common one, mm-hmm. is something you see a lot. And so it's not really conducive unless you're steering it that way as a therapist to looking at the effects of more positive interactions.
Well,
and that's one of the things they wanted to do with this study.
The fact is, there's less research on positive things that happen with couples. It's usually a conflict situation, and what do they do when they're under stress? And how does that predict what's going to happen later on? So these researchers wanted to balance that out. And in fact, you know, there was a Gottman study that they talked about from 2004 or so that I thought was neat. Again, during conflict, but he mentioned that that positive interactions like daily playful behavior, teasing your partner or things like that, you know, tickling them and stuff, was predictive of using humor and other positive emotions in a conflict situation, which helped couples to get through those conflicts, and it was more predictive later on of good things instead of the negative ones.
Tickling.
Well, you didn't specifically say that, but that was the first thing that came to mind.
I'm going to keep that in my back pocket.
You keep that for later. That's a gift that I'm giving. You're going to tell your wife, hey, daily tickling. Let's go. Right.
Sounds like something that was a common marital aid in the time of Dick Van Dyke.
Maybe.
For instance.
It was the teasing part that I liked, the joking around part that I thought was good, but it predicted humor and things like that and affection during conflict. So these researchers wanted to look at the effect of two big predictors on what's going to happen in your relationship. Contempt was the big one on the negative side, and affection was the big one on the positive side.
That's right. So they looked at 120 newlywed couples. This is the interesting part.
Within
6 months. Yep. And then they surveyed them at that time,
mm-hmm.
and then they saw them again at about 15 and a half months.
Yeah. So
since they've been married.
Mm-hmm. Several months later,
and so they wanted to look at those emotions that you as you said,
right,
more loving, caring type of emotions as opposed to
contempt
type. You know, contempt is a really good word, though. It is a little fancier than hatred, but I know I've seen it with couples who are on the verge of being divorced. And disdain's another very good word.
Well, you know, when the name-calling starts...
There's just this... It seems almost like a vacuum of affection and desire, you know?
Right. It's so negative. When you say contempt or disdain or... You know, hatred is another thing too, but it really feels negative even when you think about a couple that's expressing those kinds of feelings for one another. And again, it's one thing when it happens once in a while, but it's a different story when that becomes your go-to kind of strategy.
The interesting thing is that it might feel like there's a vacuum, but it's not necessarily a vacuum. And right. they're looking for some of the more positive things that happen. And the interesting thing is, so they have these two different tasks that they get these couples to do.
Yeah, I kind of like the tasks that they did.
Right, so they have a conflict task.
Right.
Right, so, and that, what they're doing is they get them to write down the husband and the wife,
right,
separately, get them to write down the typical things that they get into arguments and conflicts around.
Right, some ongoing problems that aren't solved.
That's it. Mm-hmm. And so they write them down separately. The interesting thing is they ended up just using the wives' conflict.
Yeah, that was one thing about the study that I found. It came out again and again. There wasn't enough time to do this and there wasn't enough time to do that. So they didn't right. have time to code all of the interactions for whether there was contempt or not for the right. husbands. They just did the wives.
It's important to note that, because in the end, some of the results might be a little skewed, because who's going to be most frustrated with that conflict that doesn't seem to have a resolution?
It's when the it's one the who
wife
picked it,
yeah. that picked it. It's yeah. going to be her.
Mm-hmm.
So they pick the conflict and then they ask them to engage in it the same way they might do at home.
Right.
And the researchers are watching. Mm-hmm. Right.
And then they rate the interactions and they look for those things, that those variables like contempt or affection, even in the problem solving kind of a situation.
That's right. And then they have what they call a love paradigm task. I feel like there should be some music behind me when I say that.
And it's right after they do the problem thing, they do the negative interaction, the conflict, and then 10 minutes later or 15 minutes later, they yeah. set them down again and do the love task.
Right. So they're there and they're told to think for about 10 minutes about their partner and the loving, positive feelings that they have for their partner.
Mm-hmm. So just they just like
contemplate that for 10 minutes.
Yep. And write them down. Write them down.
And then now come out from that and start talking to them about these more positive images and feelings and ideas they have about
and
them.
And this was another place where the time constraints jumped out at me, because originally with the first half of the group, this was a 15-minute discussion, and then they had to cut it down to 12 because they didn't... They were running.
I guess they don't want it to get too amorous
the
either
resources,
at that point.
I mean, you know. That's right. So they did the love task. They did the problem, the conflict
discussion. The conflict
discussion.
Task. Here's the interesting thing I want to say, though, about the more love-oriented task. Mm-hmm. And it's something, you know, when I do marital therapy, I've done in the past marital therapy, one of the things I do is to get the couple to think about when they first met.
Yeah,
so it's a similar thing that's being evoked here, mm-hmm. right, in the research. Mm-hmm. And you see, you know, as awful as it seems and as much contempt as you see in the room, when you get them to think about when they first met, usually,
yeah.
not always,
yep.
but usually it brings back this other feeling in the room and amongst them, and it reminds them that there isn't that vacuum.
But they care about each other.
There is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, there's a reason why they got married in the first place, right?
That's right.
Exactly. Now, what they looked at afterwards, you know, when we're talking about 15, at 15 months, was they were looking to see whether the partners were taking steps towards divorce or the alternative, how satisfied they were in their relationship. So they wanted to know about relationship satisfaction. And in fact, they used a questionnaire. It's a short form of something that a lot of psychologists use in research about couples and relationships, called the Dyadic Adjustment Scale, which just asks a lot of questions about how happy you are in your relationship. Guess who developed the short form of the Dyadic Adjustment Scale?
Dr. Brian McDonald.
Incorrect. But it was one of my teachers, actually, that I had when I was... It was interesting. It was a blast from the past to see that guy's name again on a questionnaire. And I used his version of the DAS in my thesis.
Okay.
Isn't that exciting?
Very good.
Just thought you'd like to know that.
Mm-hmm.
Well, not that you really care. But the Steps Towards Divorce questionnaire was interesting, too, because it was questions like... It started out with pretty mild things, like after you've had an argument with your partner, have you thought about divorce or separation? And then it would be questions that were a little bit more severe, like have you talked to someone besides your spouse about that you're thinking about divorce or separation?
Know, what it reminded me of is the kind of assessment you would do for suicide, where someone's just thinking about suicide versus they've made some actual plans and they've taken some actual
steps.
They've talked to a lawyer, or they talked to someone besides their husband about it, and they're looking for a place to live and that kind of thing. So you get that feeling that it gets more critical as they're following that plan through.
Right. It wasn't just a yes or no question, are you divorced or not? Which would be pretty sad when they've only been married for 15 months, right? That's a pretty short period of time. But so what did they find out? It was a little bit different for husbands and wives, right?
It was. For wives, higher levels of contempt or feelings of contempt in the conflict situation was related to them taking steps towards divorce. But again, we said earlier that in that conflict situation, it was their issue that wasn't being resolved. So it makes sense that higher levels was related to them taking steps for divorce.
Right.
You know, because it was their issue.
Although, right? I mean, honestly, when you're showing contempt for your partner in a problem-solving kind of a discussion, that's an indicator that something's not going right.
Right.
Whether it's your major problem or not.
Exactly, but it didn't come out for the men in the study, right? So,
it did in a way. It didn't happen in the conflict, but for the husbands, when there was contempt in the love situation, if they're saying negative things about their partner when they're supposed to be thinking about the positive things, well, oh, guess what?
Husbands are more likely to think about taking steps towards divorce.
Well, yeah, they may have even been thinking about them before. But you know what? The interesting thing that I thought was that for wives, higher levels of affection during the conflict situation was linked to fewer of those steps towards divorce. So if they were doing those positive, like that 2004 study I mentioned by Gottman, who said that, you know, if you're joking around a little bit in a conflict, well, that's going to tell you later on that you're probably getting along better with your partner. You're probably more likely to get through those conflict situations. Well, it's true in this study too. They found that if there was some affection being shown, even when you're talking about a problem, well, that's a really good thing. That means you really care about each other. And, you know, 15 months later or however long you look at it, they're less likely to be moving towards divorce at that point.
In the discussion, they talk about how therapists are so focused on the conflict. And again, it's kind of natural. They're coming in with a lot of conflict. Mm-hmm. But that we need to also look at the more positive context that they've lived through, that they might still be having, and bring that to the surface as well. Because the main hypothesis mm-hmm. for this was also borne out. That is that affection in the love activity,
right?
Okay, but just affection predicted relationship satisfaction, which is one thing they looked at, mm-hmm. and less proneness to going for divorce, both for husbands and for wives. So it's not just about the conflict. It's also about looking at and this is something I think it's related to a lot of what we've talked about in the past, which is how important attachment is.
Well, exactly. No, I think that sitting down with your partner and talking about what you love about them is probably not a bad thing for any couple. Am I wrong? Of course, that's a good thing to do.
Sounds good.
Showing affection for one another, talking about things that you love that the other person does, or those positive interactions are really important. And they do maintain a relationship, and it's part of maintaining that secure attachment. That's why you feel secure, is because you know the other person cares about you. So I do think generally that showing affection, whether you're in a problem situation or not, that's a good thing. This is, it's not a study that's totally surprising.
It's not surprising, except I think it's almost more relevant for people who are going into therapy,
for the therapist, but also
for the people going in, that they're understanding that the therapist shouldn't only be focused on the conflict.
Exactly.
Right?
They have to look at how...
For their own sakes.
Those other interactions.
I mean, if that's why they're going to get their marriage back together, they want to be focused on the affection too, because it predicts a better outcome for them.
Well, I think you're right that reminiscing about what got you together in the first place and the things you loved about the other person when you got together, that's a good way to remember those affectionate feelings.
It can help restore the feelings of attachment and bonding. Like I said, that we've been sort of focused on
maybe,
the show.
Maybe it can even remind you of things that you used to do when you were a new couple. Yeah, it might be fun to get back together and do those things again.
Sounds good.
We have a third study,
though. We do.
Yeah, so we have one where we get to talk about affection, and once we get past the contempt part, we get to talk about affection and stuff, and now we're going to talk about drugs. Let's talk about drugs.
Research. Well, research, really.
Yeah. Right? So this was a study that was in the
misinterpretation of research and how easily it can be misinterpreted.
Well, it's not just misinterpreting. It's misleading, I think, sometimes is what it is. And this was a study that's in the Journal of General Internal Medicine. And what they did was they looked at reputable journals. And we're talking about the major medical journals, the Journal of the American Medical Association, which is the one that I go to. If I hear Journal of the American Medical Association, that would be one of the most trusted journals you can think of in terms of
And the other one that I think of is New England Journal of Medicine. You hear this all the time.
Constantly.
Lay people know this above all other thousands and thousands of journals that are out there. This is a very, very prestigious journal. So
this is one of the journals that they looked at.
Now, the reason we're emphasizing how prestigious they are is because they've found some flaws in the way they're writing up these research papers in terms of how it can be misleading.
It makes it so hard, right? Because when I think about where am I going to get information that's reliable, when I'm searching for articles to write about on the website or to talk about on the show, the first thing I do is make sure I'm searching peer-reviewed journals, which means that when a study is going, before a study gets published, there's a bunch of other researchers that look it over to say, oh yeah, okay, this looks right. It looks like they've done a proper study and that the results are probably reasonable for us to publish in our journal, right?
Right. It has to meet a certain standard. It can't be just anybody doing it on their own with whatever standard they might have. It's meeting the standards of other people in the field who are expert.
It does. It puts it to a higher, it puts the researchers who want to be published to a higher standard because they're going to be critiqued by some of their colleagues.
And you don't get
experts.
Any higher than these journals that were being reviewed.
They are certainly the journals that have some of the best reputations, I guess you would say, among medical journals. And so they were looking for a few different things that have been criticized by experts, scientific experts, right? And one of those is something that they called, and of course, it's a medical journal, right? You've got to have fancy names for all of the different...
That's right.
And I tried to think of another way to describe it, but I couldn't really think of anything. So the first thing that they were looking for was something called surrogate outcomes.
Now, there's four different things. That was one of four, right?
Yep.
Surrogate outcomes. Let's see if we can make that make sense of that. So because we're going to confuse people right through this thing.
Right. Well,
when psychologists talk about outcomes, we talk about outcomes. They don't talk about outcomes, do they? They talk about what's the word they use?
Well, they're talking, these surrogate outcomes are something different. But yes, when psychologists are doing a research study, often what we're looking for as an outcome is, does the patient recover from anxiety, or are they rating themselves as being happier after an intervention or something like that? Outcomes in medical...
Endpoint, that's what I was looking for. So they talk about surrogate endpoint.
Endpoint,
right?
Okay.
Endpoint. We talk about outcomes, that's why...
That took you a minute, okay.
I had to find that word here in the research.
In your notes.
But they talk about endpoint. I think, I don't know, to us as psychologists, we talk about outcome variables.
Right.
But bottom line is, what effect is a particular thing that they're trying to do through medication or through therapy, right, or whatever, what kind of effect are they looking at producing in the end?
Right. If you're looking for a drug that treats cancer, does it reduce cancer rates? That would be an outcome or an endpoint that you're looking at. If you're looking at something that's supposed to reduce heart attacks, does the drug actually reduce the frequency or severity of heart attacks? And so those are endpoints or outcomes, but a surrogate outcome is when they take something that's more intermediate. Instead of that final endpoint, they take like lowering blood pressure instead of reducing heart attacks, and that's what they look at instead.
Right, because they're assuming that if you lower the blood pressure, it will reduce heart attacks, but that's an assumption that is not necessarily 100% true.
And this is where we're talking about it being misleading. So if you find out that a study says, hey, this medication really reduces your blood pressure, you think, oh, well, that's probably good for me. It'll probably lower my chance of having a heart attack. But that's not what they studied.
They didn't study that.
They didn't study that. But it's misleading in that way, or confusing, right? It might not be intentionally misleading, but it's confusing for somebody
reading.
It's
confusing. Well, it might lead you to conclusions that aren't necessarily true.
Well, and that's the next thing that's maybe even, I would say, even more confusing, which is what they called composite outcomes, which is looking at two different things that might not be equally important, but grouping them together. So saying that this medicine reduces hospitalizations and death from stroke. Well, okay.
I used a more ridiculous combination.
Here we go. Let's go.
They're looking at, let's say, medication. And when they administer this medication, what effect does it have?
Right.
The final variable they're looking at for the effect is a combination of a bunch of things.
It's more than one thing.
And so you're not sure which one of those things it's actually affecting.
Yep.
And you could have hangnail growth or death in that variable.
Right.
I'm making a ridiculous combination of things.
Sure.
But just to make that point sort of really easily digestible,
mm-hmm,
the outcome that they're looking at from that medication has some varied things in it, and you don't know which one of those things has actually been affected because they've been thrown together.
Exactly. It makes it hard to figure out what's going on in this study, what's the actual effect of the medication, because these are medication studies they're talking about. And then the third thing is something that they called disease-specific mortality, right? Because if you're looking at these diseases that might be dangerous, might be fatal diseases.
This drug, for instance,
right?
This drug is going to lower your risk of a heart attack, very specifically
right,
a heart attack, but it says nothing about whether it's going to increase your risk of breast cancer, for instance.
That's right, because it's looking at the death from that specific thing that you're trying to treat, and it doesn't look at any other factors.
because I mean, if it increases your risk of another disease, it's just as fatal or more.
If it stops heart attack but causes strokes, then
doesn't really help you.
Yeah. And they might not even know that. It's not that they're trying to hide it from you. No. It's just not what they studied.
Right. It's something that would be helpful to clarify to the reader so that they don't misinterpret.
Now, those first three, now we said there's four things. Those first three things were happening in these reputable journals. They were finding them somewhere between about 27% to 35 or 36% of the studies that they looked at. One quarter to a third, approximately, of these studies had those first three kinds of things in terms of being problems or misleading kinds of or confusing factors in the studies published in these reputable journals.
That's a lot. And then they looked at, we should say, 316 articles between 2008 and 2010.
That's right. Now, the fourth thing is one that they found even more commonly, and it's something that they call reporting relative outcomes. And a relative outcome is saying, oh, this reduces the chance of getting this disease or by 50%.
So reduces your mortality by 50%. But when you look at it closely, the 50% is that the death rate goes from 0.0002 to 0.0001.
Percent. Right.
So it's so minuscule. It's like saying, for instance, you have a 1 in 1,000 chance of getting this particular disease,
mm-hmm.
versus you have a 1.5% out of 1,000 chance of getting it. If you say it that way, versus you have a 50% higher likelihood of getting the disease.
That's right. Exactly.
From 1 to 1.5, right?
It makes it sound like a bigger effect than it is. Now, let's be clear, though. They're just talking about the summaries of the studies, because when the studies that are published in journals will have an abstract, they call it, at the beginning, that summarizes what the findings are. So in those summaries, they're making these reports that you're often seeing numbers that make the effects look maybe bigger than they are, possibly.
That's right. I mean, to go back to that example, I think that's a very powerful example, actually. Yeah. You have a 1 in 1,000 chance versus you have a 2 in 1,000 chance. So
right.
your chances have gone up 100%. You're 100% more
doubled.
Likely. It's doubled.
Twice the risk.
Twice the risk.
Saying twice the risk sounds big, but when it's a teeny
terrible,
tiny risk.
Really?
Right.
Yeah.
It's not good. And so one of the authors was saying, you know, knowing that a medication affects your blood pressure doesn't mean it's going to prevent death from heart disease. You don't really know that. Knowing that medication prevents death from a heart attack, but it increases stroke, well, that's not really what we want. That's not the medication necessarily that we want to use. So these are pretty common major issues. Now, and they only studied medication research, right? And here's the, do you know what the other thing was that they found? And this was the part I think that you'd like the best.
I think I know what you're going to say.
Is that they found that these kinds of factors were present far more often in studies that were funded by the drug companies, in commercial studies.
Right. Commercial studies, commercially funded research was almost 50% of the outcome research that they, out of those 316 studies, almost
like
about
44% or
that's right, almost half were commercially funded,
mm-hmm.
and they were much more likely to use these surrogate measures or these disease specific endpoints.
And by using those
things, you're more likely to get a statistically significant result
as to say that the medication is successful. And that's what they're saying, that the drug companies are likely encouraging, or they're choosing these endpoints or these factors to make it more likely that their drug is going to look like it's successful.
Right.
You know, and it's kind of like you say statistics can show anything. It's sort of like that, but you're really designing the study in a way that's going to, it's not guaranteeing that your drug is going to look like it has a positive impact, but it's certainly increasing the odds.
It is. If you use mortality as an outcome or as an endpoint to say that does it affect whether you're going to live or die,
mm-hmm.
it's much harder to get a significant result from that kind of a study.
And we see these kinds of things in psychological research too. It's not just medication research. And we can come back to that study about junk food and IQ, right? Which said, and all the newspaper headlines said, you know, a junk food diet reduces IQ, and that's all you know. And it looks like, oh, well, these people are probably going to fail school if all they eat is potato chips and stuff like that.
I love potato chips, by the way.
You
I'm
do.
I'm glad you said that.
And French fries. You like French fries too. I know you like those things, but But that's a misleading statement, because what we found out was what? That there was a 1 point difference, which is negligible in IQ. And it was a lot of junk food compared to, you know, it was a completely misleading headline. And that's what the newspapers grabbed onto, right?
Music to my ears.
You like that? The junk food.
I got to stay away from that. It is bad for you, of course. Well, I'm not saying it's good for you.
Reading those research studies in the newspaper can be bad for you too, because true. You get some ideas that maybe are a little bit misleading, right?
Yes.
Absolutely. So that brings us to the end of our three studies.
I think that was pretty good.
I can believe that we're done.
Three interesting studies.
Well, I thought they were interesting. It's always nice to sit down and talk to you about research studies, Giuseppe.
It's nice to get back to the old Family Anatomy studio.
Let me show you some affection by saying that it's good talking to you about this stuff.
And when we show contempt, let's remember that there could be affection in there as well somewhere. Well,
that's true. Yeah. Now, remember, contempt includes eye rolling, so stop it. All right, folks. So that brings us to the end of the episode.
You can visit us at familyanatomy.com or email us at info@familyanatomy.com.
You can find us on Facebook. You can find us on Twitter. And as usual, we'll leave you with a bit of a tune by Brother Love. And he's over at brotherloverocks.com.
Thanks for listening.
FamilyAnatomy.com